Bat Segundo can't make it this week. He tells me that reliving the 70s in any way simply isn't an option. But oh, what a great decade it was. Platform shoes, Dan Fogelberg, roller skating. Excuse me as this tear of misplaced youth trickles down my cheek and I ponder the sagging paunch and the receding hairline. Oh, time! How cruel you've been! Anyway, because we're feeling nostalgic and our therapist is scheduled to see us in about 20 minutes, we figured we'd talk to Ron Hogan, a man who has written about the 1970s, specifically what happened during that decade on film. I am here with Ron Hogan, author of The Sturtis Is Flying the Plane and also a lip blogger of Beatrice.com. Ron, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well this morning. Thank you, Ed.
Well, I wanted to first of all jump off. I was wondering, have you read David Frum's book, How We Got Here, the 70s?
Yes, I have. That was actually one of the sort of background inspirations for what I was attempting to do with my project. And then I was really interested in Frum's thesis that he basically sees the 70s as the actual sort of revolutionary era.
Yeah.
And that it's like, I mean, the late 60s is when, you know, the radicals and this like little minor wedge of revolutionaries comes out, but it's in the 70s that everything sort of spreads to the middle classes, and all of a sudden you have suburban housewives like popping pills and swapping spouses, practicing free love and all that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I was curious about this because it seemed that this book kind of drew a sort of similar kind of corollary. But I wanted to ask, outside of the obvious influence of Jaws and Star Wars, how much of today's film culture do you say would be inspired from the 70s?
I think quite a bit of it, actually. I mean, obviously, the blockbuster mentality comes from those sorts of films, but I think you have a lot of indie-minded directors today who are influenced in terms of both their artistic and their political sensibilities in terms of what smaller directors from that era, like Peter Bogdan, and I don't mean smaller, you know, aesthetically, I just mean in terms of like what they were attempting to do with their projects, you know, people like Bogdanovich, Hal Ashby, and people like that who were, you know, making small but very engaged films that were very engaged with the society around them and were making definite social statements. And I think you see that today in people like Steve Soderbergh and actually, for that matter, I think what George Clooney is doing as a director is fairly interesting in that regard.
Well, the other paramount idea of your book is that an esteemed actor like Karen Black ends up being remembered for the dreck rather than her performance in Five Easy Pieces. I mean, but at the same time, to what extent is an actor or a filmmaker responsible for their own legacy? Like, if you look at an actor today like Gabriel Byrne, he has basically taken the reins of his own career, although, you know, people... the question is how much is he really known? What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, unless you're going to be like incredibly selective like that, or I'm trying to think of somebody else who's equally, you know, so I think Daniel Day-Lewis is somebody who like that is very precise in the types of things that he will take. I mean, unless you're going to go at it with that kind of precision, it really is a sort of crapshoot. I mean, Karen Black, you know, we remember her for Airport 75 and Trilogy of Terror, and we think, you know, we sort of forget that she's that, you know, Academy nominated for Five Easy Pieces. She's in Easy Rider. She's in Day of the Locust. Any other number of fine films. Whereas we were, you know, somebody like Robert Duvall, we remember as a great actor because of and understandably so, because of the Godfather films and Apocalypse Now. But you know, at that same time, we kind of forget that, you know, like the 7% solution and the Betsy. Or the Fortune. I can never remember if it's the Betsy or the Fortune that he's in, but one of those horrid little movies.
Well, also, Karen Black also became a writer of low-budget films in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is, I think, part of the legacy is that as the great actors and actresses of the 70s, you know, go into the 80s and 90s, you know, for older actors, it's much easier to find those, like, you know, dignified, mature parts that... For men in their, like, you know, late 40s and 50s and early 60s, for women it's much harder, and you do sort of end up like having to take those B movie parts.
Yeah, or B-movie directing jobs like Ida Lupino. But, well, I wanted to go and talk about how this book came about. Did the Peter Bogdanovich interview sort of inspire the book? Did that come first? Did that come after? Or?
That came fairly late in the game. Basic inspiration was that as much as I like Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, Peter Biskin's book,
yeah,
I think it's a great book about the six or seven directors that it's about. But, you know, while it provides a lot of biographical information about them and about the era in which they and the studios that they worked with operated, it's really kind of only the tip of the iceberg, and there's not a lot of surprises in it. I mean, you know, at this point, nobody really needed to be, you know, told that, you know, Martin Scorsese or Francis Ford Coppola or Steven Spielberg were great directors. I mean, we all kind of knew that. And, you know, that being reminded about Hal Ashby is all well and good. But the rest of it was, you know, it was kind of just filling us in on a story that we essentially already knew the outline of. And there was just so much more else to 70s films to be considered. I mean, you know, for example, there's almost no mention of Cassavetes in that book. There is definitely, like, no mention of, say, like, John Waters or Larry Cohen or any number of other great, you know, independent directors, like, operating under the surface. And there's no mention of a lot of what was going on just in the pure mainstream commercial outlets, like the disaster movies and the blaxploitation films.
Sure.
And things like that. So I wanted to do a book that sort of took on the whole spectrum of 70s movies, and I also wanted one that had a lot of color photography.
Oh, yes, yes, there's a lot of nice pictures in this. Well, going back to this idea of Biskin, you mentioned in this book how accidental a lot of casting decisions are, and that's not necessarily limited to the 70s, but all throughout time. But, like, one of the examples you use is Donald Pleasence being casted in Halloween, which came after Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee said no to John Carpenter. Given the nature of last-minute casting, do you think it's sort of fair to kind of call the 1970s as the decade of great American movies? How much do you subscribe to that idea?
You know, looking at those films, I mean, I think we possibly are on the verge of another renaissance now, but it's like, I mean, you just look at so many of those great movies from the 70s, and, you know, you compare it to stuff in the 80s and 90s, and sure, you're always going to be able to come up with, like, some sort of counter-argument, but there was just, like, such a preponderance of really amazing stuff coming out from, say, like, let's say about, like, 68, even, because, you know, if you go back to from Faces and Targets and Easy Rider up until about 78, 79, you know, there's just, like, boom, 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 such a great wave. And I think just in terms of the way that those films are very actively engaged with what, you know, what was going on in American culture during that era, and that kind of mise-en-scene, to take a film word, just we haven't really seen that a lot in the last 25 years as much as we did then.
Well, what we're seeing now, and what actually Biskin argues in his second book, is the whole one for them, one for me kind of school of thought. But going back to, like, George Clooney, for example, it's like, well, he's still doing Ocean's 13 while he's also using that to kind of do these other projects like Good Night and Good Luck and the like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Clint Eastwood built his entire career as a director on that until he won the Oscar for Unforgiven and then, you know, could finally do whatever he wanted. But, I mean, you know, remember, like, all throughout the 80s, it was like, you know, I'll do Bird, but then I'll make another movie with, yeah, you know, with the orangutan for you. Or, well, I think he was done with the orangutans, but, you know, I'll do Bird, and then I'll do a Dirty Harry film for you. Fine.
Sure. Well, I mean, the thing I guess I'm sort of trying to sort of point out here is, yeah, that this kind of mentality of one for us and one for them, or, you know, the accidental casting choices, it's not necessarily exclusive to any particular decade. So, mm-hmm, why do you think 70s can be sort of counted upon as the sort of, you know, decade of great American cinema? I mean, there's been arguments that, you know, the 80s actually is also or the 90s even, is a great sort of decade of American cinema. And it's kind of difficult to sort of focus on that since we're too close to those decades.
Right. Well, again, I think it goes back possibly to the content. I mean, David Kippen seems to have a really interesting idea in his new book, The Schreiber Theory,
mm-hmm,
and I'm totally on base with him about, you know, getting past the whole idea of the auteur. I think that that's very basic and altogether too romantic way of looking at films is to say, oh, it's the director's vision brought forth. And he talks about the importance of the screenwriter in all of this, and I just think that during that period, there's the scripts show a level of engagement and a level of commitment that are just really phenomenal to watch them grappling with their subject matter, grappling with the tensions that were a lot of people felt in the late 60s and early 70s were literally tearing the country apart. And sure, you had any amount of escapist entertainment during that period, but you also had films that really sort of like tackled this stuff head on.
Sure. Well, you also point out, though, that to go back to the whole Schreiber theory, which I think holds some validity, but simultaneously you point out that, it was Polanski's specific choices for the ending of Chinatown that he had to argue there with Town for, like, every single page.
So, I mean, that's the thing about film is that it is an incredibly collaborative medium in a way that not a lot of artistic mediums are. I mean, painting tends to be a very solitary thing, and unless you're like a Kostabi who just sort of like is an idea guy and has other people go and do it. Writing you usually go off and do on your own. But things like film and theater and opera are very collaborative mediums, and so there's no one person that, has like total authority for the final product. And particularly in film where it's not only an artistic medium, but it is frankly a business. And so every artistic decision is also a financial decision at some level, and that there are financial considerations that you have to work within.
Well, even Bogdanovich in the interview in the book even acknowledges that he wasn't entirely smart or certain how to actually make these films with that money question in mind. Do you think this kind of gets in the way of a lot of, like, say, underexposed directors, like, for example, Paul Bartel, who I felt was just really seriously misunderstood as a filmmaker, or even Sam Peckinpah, who had to constantly, like, obliterate himself and then sort of restore himself from the ashes, as I think John Milius said in some documentary or something like that. How can sort of that level of sort of artistic flourishing, like from the 70s or from any other time period, how can this even be a factor when it's all run by money?
Yeah, Cassavetes, I think, is a great example of that, where, he just fought tooth and, he would go off and do his acting jobs and get some of his money that way and then go to his backers. But, I mean, here is a guy who was really just going out and making, raising the funds himself and then shooting the film himself. John Waters was doing that for years, making films for himself in Baltimore and staying out of the Hollywood structure except, for distribution purposes. Another really amazing film from the 70s, Charles Burnett, I'm going to get the title of this wrong.
That's okay, there's hundreds of films from that decade.
But, there's basically two ways you can do this. You can either be that kind of like, small, maverick, independent filmmaker like a Cassavetes or a Waters or a Charles Burnett in the first couple of decades of his career, where it's like you hold all the power by, doing as much of it yourself as possible. Or you can step into the studio system and realize that at that point you have to engage in the trade-off of, okay, I have access to the resources that will allow me to do, much more than I could on my own, but in order to do that, I may have to make some degree of compromise, whether it's in casting choices or locations or something like that.
Or even type, like you mentioned, for example, one of my favorite films of the 70s that's totally underrated is The King of Marvin Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Classic example of, like, as you point out, an audience that didn't understand Jack Nicholson in the quiet role. So you have those restrictions in place, too. I mean, if an actor is typecast, Hal Ashby was sort of a rare case, for example, where he was able to make, like, movies like The Last Detail under the studio system. We don't have anything like that, really, in place anymore. You have to... Hal Ashby, though, was somewhat uncompromising, though.
Yeah, we really don't have anything like that today, where we have that... the big studio system that was willing to deal with, like, both large and small films like that. Back in the 70s, of course, we had a lot of smaller studios, and certainly the influence of Roger Corman, as felt within my book, is enormous. we don't really have that sort of, like, you know, beat movie platform today where young, you know, where young filmmakers like Coppola and Scorsese and Bogdanovich could sort of, like, you know, break, you know, do their breakout films and then get noticed by the studios and pick things up.
Or even get trained, like, for example, Sissy Spacek, James Cameron, Joe Dante, Paul Bartel, all hired by Corman.
Right.
Even Dick Miller, a great character actor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Paul Bartel, yeah. You know, Ron Howard.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see, like, if I cut out, don't worry about this. It's the battery, and I'll just put,
I'll
plug it back. But, it'll be interesting to see. I'm trying to remember if it was John Sayles who, in the very back of the book, has the quote about looking at The Godfather and just seeing it as a perfect Corman film. You know, a little sex, a little violence, a little social commentary, and, you know, keep the camera moving. And so it'll be interesting to see, like, how, you know, how much Da Vinci Code fills out that model, given Ron Howard's background as a Corman director.
Oh, you have at the back of the book the Jonathan Demme.
Jonathan Demme.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about some of the films and how the way this book is organized. First of all, it's interesting to see that you mentioned, like, for example, Phantom of the Paradise, which is a very another underrated Brian De Palma film. Although, would De Palma be classified as a 70s filmmaker or an 80s filmmaker, given, like, two of his finest movies, like Dress to Kill and Blowout, were made just after the 70s?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I throw him into the 70s because, you know, that's where I am. But I definitely, I mean, a lot of these guys straddle a line. I mean, you know, is Scorsese a 70s filmmaker because of Taxi Driver, or is he an 80s filmmaker because of The Color of Money, or is he a 90s filmmaker because of Goodfellas? So it's hard to make those kinds of choices.
Well, you also write that the Muppet movie sort of serves as this voyage of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, could you elaborate on this?
Oh, you know, in this very sort of, like, archetypal Joseph Campbell hero of a thousand faces sort of way. I mean, you know, it is Kermit the Frog's, you know, quest for, you know, he literally travels the country in pursuit of, you know, the dream of stardom and, you know, encounters setbacks along the way. And
it's actually a Candide tale of all the cameos, you know?
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, and everybody wanted to be in that film. It's amazing. Like, you know, if you look at that film now, and, you know, when was the last time you saw a film with, like, that many incredible cameos in it?
Well, it's actually interesting. I mean, the only thing I can think of is Rat Race, which was kind of an attempt to do sort of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no sort of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I guess that might even be a sort of forerunner for the Muppet movie. I don't know.
Yeah, it's, that's a very good argument, I think. I wonder to what extent, I mean, just budgetary concerns make it impossible to do that kind of film today. I mean, I think the closest we have, apart from Rat Race, is, you know, to the extent to which, you know, Soderbergh is able to get the guys together for the Oceans movies. But even then, it's like, I mean, there aren't really many cameos in there. It's, you know, just like the guys getting together to make a movie.
Unless it's like Woody Allen getting a whole bunch of big name actors for scale, maybe it's just entourages, personal trainers, and the like. You know,
mm-hmm.
You've divided this book into genres, but do you think that films can really sort of fit into these neat taxonomies? Because if you look at, like, the 70s, there's great films like Nashville or Oh Lucky Man, and you can argue that those are actually sort of almost without category.
Absolutely, I mean, genre is a convenient placeholder, but, you know, any film I think can basically be, you know, quantified into, like, a couple of different genres and ultimately into no genre. I mean, you look at Alien. Obviously, I have it in the science fiction movies, but at the same time, it's a working class film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are basic grunt astronauts, you know, just doing their jobs. Genre makes a convenient marker for marketing and for pegging things towards audience, but really, I think fundamentally, deep down, films deal with the same fundamental underlying tensions in their subject matter and in their approaches to it.
Okay. Well, you mentioned in your acknowledgement sections that you were actually holed up at Mark's pad to do research. I was wondering what kind of research you did in Los Angeles.
Oh, I spent 2.5 days with Manoah Bowman, who is an absolute phenomenal photo editor.
Uh-huh.
My editor, Karen Gerhardt, and I went out with Manoah to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Photo Library and we spent 2.5 days pouring through thousands of photos to get the 300 that actually made it into the book.
Wow. Well, there was also the interesting sort of note from her, from him rather, that that he was having difficulty with the reds.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, you know, how much of these photos that you were coming across were sort of faded or muted, or maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
The photos, a lot of them seem to be in pretty good. I mean, basically what we were dealing with is, like, when I had, like, actual photos to look at, they tended to be black and white. A lot of the color stuff that we were looking at tended to be slides. So it was harder for my untrained eye to sort of gauge what the quality of the composition was. I mean, that's obviously something that he, as a trained photo editor, was able to gauge much more effectively, but I think he's right that it, because it's still so recent in our history, we don't deal with the preservation issues as readily as we do for older films that, you know, we can see the history much more blatantly.
Yeah, well, you mentioned also, well, the photo editor's note says that, you know, it's easier to preserve before 1970 rather than after 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, and yeah, I think for, like, technical issues of, like, you know, what the film was actually composed of chemically, I think film in the 70s became much more disposable and thus much harder to preserve.
Now, to what extent is Surtis a coffee table book, and to what extent is it sort of a chronicle of 1970s cinema?
I'd say about half and half.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, it's a coffee table book. It's intended to look pretty and, you know, to be something that you can flip through and say, oh, I remember that film, or, you know, look at this. But, I mean, that's just our way to get your foot in the door. And once you're in there, I mean, really did want to say something about what was going on in 70s Hollywood, what was going on in 70s America, and how the two interacted with each other. I mean, it absolutely is intended to be a serious meditation on what these films were about and why they're significant.
Well, the other thing that's an interesting sort of omission from this book, and I know that your book is mainly dealing with films, but the influence of, you know, critics, cultural arbiters, Pauline Kael, Stanley Kaufman, Andrew Saris. I mean, surely they have some responsibility for how 1970 cinema was perceived back then and how it's perceived today. I was wondering if you might want to elaborate on this.
Yeah, and definitely, I think, you know, at least in American culture, from Saris on, you know, picking up off of the Cahiers crowd, I mean, definitely in the 70s, well, in the late 60s and into the 70s, sophisticated audiences definitely took their film-going cues, I think, from people like Saris and certainly from Kael. I think, like, Bonnie and Clyde is one of the classic examples of that, that if it weren't for the championing of a couple of critics, the studio might have just really been ready and willing to sort of abandon it after an initially weak performance. So there's definitely some level among one segment of the film audience to take what was being told to them by the critics seriously and to relate to film on that level. But, you know, once you get into the later 70s and into the blockbuster era, it becomes Hollywood reverts, I guess, in a way to becoming much more review proof in a way, or at least a huge chunk of films do it. I think
I might be able to help you out here. I mean, it's also kind of I think what people sort of discount and we take for granted now is back then there weren't VCRs or DVDs.
Absolutely.
You know, a film, it either hit the waves, it made the rounds, or it was gone, or you'd catch it on television.
Mm-hmm. And too, it wasn't until about the mid-70s that films opened everywhere all at once. I mean, the initial pattern used to be, you know, pretty much what you see only nowadays for, you know, for smaller art films, where it's like, you know, it would open up in New York and Los Angeles, then it would spread out to a couple of smaller cities, and, you know, it could take months before it would get out to the suburbs.
Well,
it was only, you know, starting with blockbusters like Jaws and Star Wars that they just said, you know, that quality films were opened everywhere all at once. I mean, originally that was something you just did to get a film out there and get everything before the word of mouth spread about how terrible it was so that you could pull it out a couple weeks later and, you know, having made your money.
It certainly provided a good career for Herschel Gordon Lewis. Well, there's also, I mean, you know, if you, like, see a film, like, for example, the immediate example that comes to mind is if you see Shaft Goes to Africa, if you watch that movie on DVD today, you see the boom guy actually in the shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, given the fact that movies were made really fast and there wasn't the level of scrutiny necessarily applied, you know, do you think that a time like that could even happen again? Because now it's like we live in a culture now where, you know, if you say some soundbite or if it's dead, you know, you're almost dead before release these days.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, you look at, you know, go on the Internet Movie Database, and, you know, they have that whole section for, like, you know, errors and, or goofs in films. And you do have guys who, like, you know, will pick obsessively over whether the boom guy is in the shot or not, or, you know, whether you can see the lighting guy reflected in somebody's sunglasses, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And yet it doesn't seem to hurt hurt the flow of production any much. And, you know, there are always going to be people who, you know, are not willing to suspend their disbelief to the point where it's like that they're looking for ways to say, oh, this isn't real. But there's, I think, you know, people go to the films in order to suspend their disbelief, in order to just, like, you know, throw themselves into another world for 90 minutes to 2 hours. And things are going to, you know, occasionally, like, you know, there's going to be the occasional cock-up, but, you know, people are generally willing to overlook that in terms of, you know, just surrendering themselves to that vision.
But going back to your distinction here, going back to Karen Black about how she's remembered, you know, in Airport 75 rather than Five Easy Pieces, factor that in light of the sort of culture of scrutiny. And what you have here is kind of a situation where, like, now an actor might even have more scrutiny against him while before he actually makes a film, so you can't even allow word of mouth to spread. It's like word of mouth spreads so instantaneously now due to the culture of the internet that how can any kind of golden era occur again?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And getting back to what you said earlier about, you know, VCRs and DVD players, I mean, it was easy to remember Karen Black in, you know, Airport 75 for decades because that was so iconic. And there wasn't much way to watch her other films, you know, unless they popped up, like, on, you know, late, on a UHF channel late at night. Nowadays, there is such an incredible backlog of all of film history. And, all, you know, TV series are coming out on DVD now. So there's, like, even like, you know, disposable sitcoms and you know, cop dramas have been preserved forever. So, yeah, it's, you know, basically, you know, you can avail yourself of somebody's entire career if you wanted to, and it'd be, you know, be interesting to see, like, you know, in terms of, like, typecasting, you know, how does somebody escape, like, you know, an entire career that is, you know, viewable at a moment's notice?
Or, you know, not only that, but also the fact that, since, again, we're dealing with a money-generated market, it's very strange when you get into, like, television shows on DVD, you know, Three's Company, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I mean, who the heck is watching Three's Company on DVD? Or, you know, it's like I saw a commercial last night for, like, you know, Hogan's Heroes. You know, I mean, I love Hogan's Heroes as much as the next guy, but, you know, who out there is actually going to watch all 30 episodes of season 3? I mean, it's like if you want to watch, you know, if you want to watch Bob Crane, you're going to just go rent Autofocus or something and find out about it that way.
Well, then again, you know, you should see my DVD collection. I have Supergirl Special Edition. Do I know? Well, there's a reason why I purchased it, which I'm not going to tell you, but it probably involves Helen Slater and being smitten with her when I was young, which is a really sad reason to buy a DVD. But there are, I mean, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, if we're talking about sort of a culture of distinction or finding out, you know, a person's career, I guess what I'm sort of trying to see, if we are dealing with, like, a culture of specialization, then how can any sort of, like, actor's work or best work, how can Karen Black's work in Five Easy Pieces make it into the mass appeal where it's understood by the populace that this is a fantastic actor. She's not just a stewardess flying the plane.
Yeah, and that's where things get tricky. I mean, you basically need to just, you know, have enough people going out there and, you know, essentially shouting and beating people over the head and saying, you know, go back and look at Five Easy Pieces. Look at Karen Black. She's incredible at it. And, yeah, it's debatable how much patience that the audiences out there have for that. I mean, especially when there's, like, so much, you know, to work with. You know, making an individual case for any one actor and, you know, competing for people's attention spans that way becomes so much more difficult.
Okay, well, Ron, I know your phone is dying, but thank you so much. It's a pleasure.